Welcome to the Pepin Podcast, a research into practice conversation between pre-service and in-service teachers and teacher educators about research and practice. For episode 11, I'm joined by two pre-service teachers and two university teacher educators to discuss Mikhail Kavenestat and colleagues' 2020 paper, The Phantasmatic Logics of Physical Literacy from Sport Education and Society. Over to you, Clancy.
Article and blog were interesting. I think there's a lot of nuances when we think about physical literacy that I think the authors use the logics lens to evaluate. And I myself, when thinking about this issue, have been on both sides of the approach or the construct when we think about physical literacy. When it started to gain popularity in the U.S. The conversation from last week, I was a little concerned about physical literacy. And even in some of my research, I started to look in that regard. I was wondering if, because of the accountability era, again, from last week's discussion, was the profession perhaps pandering to the next new idea or the next silver bullet, as Ash has pointed out, in the authors themselves. I've changed my thoughts more, and I realize now that certainly there are benefits to the construct of physical literacy from an organic approach, the individual journey for each child to travel in a safe and safe learning environment for physical education and movement. So I've moved the other direction, but I think there's certainly a lot to consider. You know, what the authors discussed in their original article about is this construct intended to replace or become the new goal of physical education? And that's where I think we have to be careful. I continue to pose the question to my teacher candidates. And I guess anyone who will listen, but why can't physical education be physical education? Why do we have to always think about it from the new vision or from the new goal or from a comparative standpoint to other disciplines? I think physical education has tremendous merits, and that's what I worry about when we start thinking about these constructs.
The part in the blog and the paper that resonated most with me was the narratives, and that the narrative around physical literacy is that there's these ideal futures. The end point is when children or adults become physical literate, and they move away from those catastrophic scenarios of sedentary behavior and illness and disease. And within that narrative, I feel we're missing conversations for things that I think are important to have conversations about, things like around pleasure and meaning and spirituality and play within movement and forms of movement, and how they can contribute to a good life and a life worth living. I don't think we have those narratives when we talk about physical literacy, and that concerns me.
So my key sort of take home from reading the blog was, yeah, it might be great for learning how to do something, But there's no why there. There's no why do I need to do this. So perhaps if we're going down the physical literacy route, we might miss a lot of the education part of our physical education. But then if we're sort of going to insist on it, it's going to be paired with things that can accompany that approach to include the why as well as the how.
I was sort of just thinking, physical literacy, what are the goalposts to be physically literate? If it's just to be going for a, a walk so that you're not living a sedentary lifestyle, is that physically literate, or do we define being an Olympian as being physically literate because you've then physically mastered that particular discipline?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a key in kind of understanding physical literacy itself, and then there's a key in kind of understanding what the aspirations are for an approach or a philosophy. And you know, to me, the fact that Cam and Charlie don't know what physical literacy is a reflection of the PGC course, the teacher education course that we have, because we don't explore physical literacy as a concept. And I guess that comes down to our own choices within the program of what knowledge is valid, which knowledge isn't valid. So, you know, we could argue, given the place of physical literacy in the vocabulary of PE and within the aspirations of many teachers, both nationally and internationally, then that's an oversight on our behalf. And we're privileging knowledge that we think is more valuable than other knowledge. And it's almost like the null curriculum. What you don't teach, people don't learn about. And I think that's a point that we need to take on in terms of understanding the concepts. I mean, I've had the pleasure of working with Margaret Whitehead in my previous institution and listening to her talk about physical literacy and getting a real sense of the philosophy, monoism, the mind and the body as one, you know, how we develop, there's no separation between mind and body, you know, you're not working on one and not the other. And her, you know, real unwillingness to define this as an approach to teaching, as a way of doing things, and then listening to and looking at the work that's coming out of Australia and Canada and the definition of physical literacy and almost the measurability of physical literacy. And it was those two extremes that I think are really interesting in this, so that any idea has different conceptions within policy and research. And what I found really interesting in this was the stark contrast between the dialogue that's happening between researchers over almost the philosophical and the fundamental, the actionable notions of physical literacy in the research, and the lack of discussion occurring in policy. So policy has already moved beyond research and taken this on as a really good thing to do. And again, the beatific and the horrific narratives were things that I think can be applied to physical education more generally in terms of those narratives. We have an inactive population, children are moving less and less, we need to do something else, physical literacy is the answer. And part of me thought, well, this is Seedentop's notions of sport education in 1982 when he presented it in Brisbane. You know, he saw it as replacing PE. It reminds me of the work coming out of the US on health optimizing physical education, which is a replacement of physical education. It is still got it in the title, but it's a, you know, this is what you are doing in PE. And I do think there are some really good things. I mean, I find Margaret Whitehead's ideas very interesting, but very challenging to read. I mean, if you ever read her original book, I think it's quite conceptually dense. And I don't mean that in a conceptually stupid. I mean that in conceptually, viscous almost. It's heavy lifting in terms of reading. And I think that the consequences of what's going on in other countries with physical literacy is a move away from the difficult language, I guess, that's in there.
Yeah, and I guess it's also then trying to practically apply it and have pedagogy that's informed by physical literacy. And that can be, I think, really challenging when you're trying to enact those philosophies that Margaret Whitehead originally conceptualized physical literacy on. And I think the more you try and make it practical, potentially the further away from that philosophical starting place you get, so much so that you get this seductive practice that it ends up being anything anyone wants it to be. And I find that really difficult and challenging with physical literacy as well.
And to answer your question, Cam, to be physically literate is a personal thing. So the Olympian is physically literate. The person who goes out for a walk is physically literate. That's the extent of their literacy. And it's the challenge of helping people reach their potential. It's a potential thing to me, I guess. The way I would conceive it is that physical literacy is potential. Now, one of the counter questions is, if you can be physically literate, can you be physically illiterate? Because you haven't reached your potential. And my reading of it is that you're always trying, you know, your journey to physical literacy is varied. It changes, it moves, depending on who you are and what you're going through. So it's a very malleable and pliable thing that's responsive to the situation that you're in, which is really beatific. It's really romantic that you can, you know, I guess that you can go through these different stages. But then you've got people who want to measure it and try to understand it, and show how, if we're going to apply this to a school-wide curriculum, then how do we show that young people are becoming more literate? How does that notion of physical literacy apply? You see reading age, don't you, in schools? I wonder if we'll ever get a movement age. I've never even considered that, but you know, and is that even relevant or applicable? But you know, I wonder how the notions of literacy, other people have completely gone against this notion that, you know, we're muddling the water of what literacy actually means, and it is, you know, language skills, and it's not, you know, physical literacy. And you can see some quite interesting debates from people outside of physical education in terms of what physical literacy is. So I think it's quite an emotive term as well.
That's interesting. You bring up some good points, and Alex as well, seduction, romance. And I think there's something to be said about that. As Alex pointed, it almost becomes anything you want it to be. And that's what we certainly have to be weary of. You know, it's funny, you also brought up assessment. And, you know, in my original, you know, skepticism when physical literacy first started was because of my bias in regards to the accountability piece. Bring up, well, how do we measure it? And that's the first thing that comes up when you think of this construct, or in research and policy and people that are, you know, looking at it from both angles, that's one of the arguments. Well, we have to think about it from measurement, or think about it from assessment. And, you know, and then that gets back to what Alex says. As soon as you start thinking about that, that changes, as Charlie pointed out, that moves the goalposts, and that moves away from the original premise, the original, you know, original idea, the romance of the original theory and construct. And then your question about, is if someone can become physically literate, is there such thing as being physically illiterate? That's a really intriguing question. The way I talk about physical literacy with my teacher candidates is that it's a continuum. So I don't know if I have an answer to that. And you know, you mentioned Margaret Whitehead and her writing. And I, the way I interpret this construct is that it's a continuum. So I suppose, if I were to be cornered and to have to come up with an answer to your question, I guess there is no such thing in my mind as physically illiterate. There's this continuum, and people are literate in their own ways along this continuum. Some are more physically literate than others, and some are less.
I think we probably have to bring the environment and the context into that as well. that you're physically literate in combination with your environment and the environment that you want to move in. If you want to gain something from a movement environment where you're unable to do it, then we need to support you to be physically literate within that environment. But then that changes to the measurement, where it's, these are the standards, this is what you need to be able to do at this age, and you know, you need this competence, you need this confidence, that you need this knowledge. And that makes, from the measurement point of view to engaging with your environment point of view, makes physical literacy a really wide ranging concept. Which one would be, you know, I'd want to ask Cameron and Charlie as new teachers, which one would be better for them to guide their decision making as PE teachers, and the conversations and the narratives that they have with students, or maybe even physical literacy doesn't help those conversations.
Yeah, I was just thinking of I've been looking at the scheme of work for the school I'm at now today, and on there there's not a tick box per se, but it's by year nine a student will be able to do this in regards to an invasion sport. They'll be able to do this skill. They'll be able to avoid opposition. I suppose that would fit into this whole debate about physical literacy and assessing it, and where would somebody fit? And do you complete physical literacy? If it's on a continuum, there's a top end and a bottom end. Once you've achieved it, do you then regress, or can you diversify, I suppose would be a good word for it?
The idea of completing it seems odd to me, considering that we've just spoke for the last 5 minutes about someone who's always physically literate in some way, shape or form. So why, it might just be an issue with terminology, I don't know, but we're chasing something that they're already at. And to me, it seems that this is just very much focused on skill acquisition. Aren't those skills acquired whilst following other models as well, rather than just solely focusing on the physical literacy?
I mean, Charlie, to get your point, is those are actually seem historic from the previous iteration of the national curriculum, where by this stage, you know, this would have happened. But it almost comes back to the idea of last time. It's a normalisation. It's, you know, it's a population. So nationally, most children should be, by this age, able to do this or that. And therefore, you have benchmarks for achievement, which is, I guess, what those who are looking for some form of assessment might talk about in terms of physical literacy, the normalization of physical literacy. What would most people be able to do? But then I wonder, go back to the notion of can you be physically illiterate? I'd love to take credit for, but it's a question that Mikhail Kavenistat has asked me, and we've had conversations about it, so I have to give credit to him about that as a term. And I suspect it's something that encouraged him to, you know, to lead on this paper and to explore it. But I would say that my level of literacy is probably quite high in English. But my Mandarin I'm illiterate. Yeah. Okay, I don't recognize the characters, I don't recognize the language. But if I translate that to movement, you know, the notion of literacy, but if I apply that to physical literacy as opposed to, you know, language literacy, then can I be illiterate? So, or can I be barely literate? Mm-hmm. I guess my competencies in sports, some sports are quite high, but my competencies in sports I've never played are probably quite low, although I might have a level of physical awareness, I guess, to be reasonably good at it. Best example I might give from my own experience is when I moved from being a skier to a snowboarder. I didn't start in the same place because I understood snow conditions. I understood what edges did. I understood what balance meant. I understood how the snow moved. So I made much quicker progressions. So if I, understanding verbs and nouns and understanding sentence structure, etc., might give me that advantage if I decided to learn Mandarin, as an example. But I just wonder whether that moves us towards the notion of literacy and illiteracy, or whether actually there is a body literacy almost. I don't want to bring in a new term, but there's a mind-body monoism that allows me to understand what it means to move that would be the same in language.
It's hard to dispute the monoist approach, for sure. Mind and body connection. I'd like to kind of get into some of the other potential dangers that we have to think about with these types of constructs. The authors brought up economic interests, everything from merchandise to tickets, which kind of gets back to, again, last week's discussion and how physical literacy is being portrayed or used. And that's what we have to be worried about, when we think about these constructs. Ash, in his blog, and the authors themselves, you know, bring attention to this. They say, is this another dystopian or utopian narrative in the long line of history in PE in the profession?
Yeah, I mean, when I read this, I immediately thought the same could be said for modern practice. That this the same could be said for lots of approaches that we take. And yet, I wondered in reading the paper whether physical literacy was the future. Is it achievable through different pedagogical approaches? Because I'm an advocate for the horses for courses and choosing, you know, deciding what it is you want to learn and then choosing the way that you want to teach it. So what are your outcomes, rather than we have this way of teaching? And I'd really like to see somebody unpacking how physical literacy could be taught through different approaches. I'm not suggesting it becomes a model, and then it comes back to meaningful PE. We've talked about that previously on the blog and my discussions with Tim Fletcher about whether it could be a model or not a model. And again, is so these phantasmical logics were the ones that really interested me. But, you know, how could they be applied to other approaches or not? So that we're actually, you know, I could, you know, see a whole series of papers using the same, you know, theoretical structure to look at different approaches. I'd actually love to see it done on the multi-skills, on the multi-activity sports technique approach, you know, in terms of what the logics are around there. So I think there's a discussion here about physical literacy, but I think there's also a discussion around these beatific and horrific narratives that pervade PE generally, because you could change physical literacy and insert something else into that space, and I think these logics would still apply. So, you know, Charlie and Cameron, I guess the question is at you. Do you think that there are these horrific narratives around health? I think they are around health. If someone can object to me, you know, around the lack of movement, the need for physical education to occupy that space as being a motivator for you to be teachers or not?
I think that's an interesting one. I've always thought about going into PE because it develops more of a holistic approach. But then that's from the outdoor sort of background. So you learn to appreciate where you are, what you're doing, as well as developing with that. So I've always enjoyed it more for the teaching people new things, whether that be a physical skill or an appreciation for something my motivator for being a teacher hasn't been to get people off the sofa to go and do sport. It's using sport for enjoyment.
Yeah, for me, it's more come from teaching people that if, like, the effect of what physical activity can have on you, not just from a physical perspective, but like whenever you're, say, stressed or down or whatever, that, or you're struggling to break up like things in the day, especially if, like now working from home. There's something there to move the mind away and just relax everything down and reset. For me, that's I think I've answered the question there, but I'm not sure.
I don't think it's the right answer. I'm just sort of interested in terms of how we unpack and unpick these ideas. I mean, I think I'll let Clancy and Alex come in, and then I'll kind of pose a final kind of question or query.
Well, I think it's altogether likely, Ash, that whether we're talking about Cam and Charlie in their induction years in the profession, or your educators like myself, that we've used both beatific and horrific narratives to advocate for the importance of physical education. I can speak for myself and say that I absolutely have. And I like how the authors have kind of explained these nuances, because they are distinct and unique. But I would imagine that most professionals in my neck of the woods, whether at the higher ed level or K through 12 in the trenches, have probably used both narratives to explain the importance of and value of physical education.
I think one of my concerns with physical literacy is this idea that there is an end, that it can be achieved. We then start having questions or conversations about what does that look like, and it concerns me that just narrows what children can be, what they can be like, what adults can be like. This is what a physical literate individual looks like. That is all that can be, and we work towards that. Whereas I think, and they make the point in the actual paper, actually, that there's potentially hundreds, thousands of different ways to be physically literate in the world and engage in movement and physical activity in the world. So let's keep it open. So yeah, I'd be really concerned on it being an end goal or something that we look to achieve, as that closes off lots of opportunities for us to explore.
I think it's like the limitless potential is that in everybody to get better. And that makes it aspirational, but it's also, I guess, it's physiological as well, and neurological and all sorts of things. As we get older, things are physiologically we recover slower, we develop muscles slower, we lose bone density. There are physiological things that inhibit us. That's one thing. I mean, you know, every time I learn a new movement in gymnastics, it takes me a long time to get there, but then there's so much more I cannot yet do. So somewhere there is my potential, but I'm being inhibited by my own ability to even practice and do those things. I play cricket, and I played cricket for years, and in the team I play in, I play for the second team, and there's a first team. When I step up to the first team, there's a whole new level. They're massively ahead of where I normally play. So while I may be perceived to be physically literate within the confines of where I normally play, I then become almost, less literate. Is that okay? certainly my average suggests that I'm less literate, if I move up a team. So there is that sense of progression, and sometimes you can't progress because the team you're playing in is the right level for you. And to stretch yourself, you have to leave the team you're playing in and find a team that's slightly better. You see what I'm saying? So it's, you know, there are constructs that deliberately is the wrong word, but social constructs and interactive constructs and just
ecological.
Yeah, absolutely. That get in the way of those things. So I have this potentially boundless potential. That's fantastic. Never write that in an assignment, either of you, or I'll be telling you, you know. But there's this potentially boundless potential in different ways to continue to get better. But there are environmental, physiological, neuro, all sorts of constraints to go into that that isn't really good at all, especially when we're talking about monism as in mind and body, and not dualism in terms of mind. You know, what the mind wants, the body can't progress, but it's still one thing.
Ash, if I could add to that, I think that really points to what Alex is stressing, that first off, there's no end. It's a continuum, and it's always moving, right? And then on top of that, we all go up and down based on our environment, based on the conditions. Everything is always changing. So, I mean, you're exactly right. I played hockey last night at 10 o'clock at night and with a bunch of the old guys on the ice. And I said to myself, wow, 5 years ago, I'd be able to skate much faster than I did now. And because it's constantly moving, right? I'm not as physically literate in hockey as I once was. Although don't tell anybody I said that, but you get my point. But if I'm playing hockey on the ice with my kids tonight at 5 at practice, I'm a rock star to them. They can't keep up. So it's all based on the ecological conditions, right? For sure.
I don't know if this adds anything, but I've Googled what physical literacy is. And it describes it as an integral part of a lifestyle. It doesn't define it as you being able to do something, as it is part of a lifestyle.
And that just tells you that Google's not always right. but I think that's, you know, who wrote that? I mean, that came from somebody wrote that, but they don't necessarily understand the term. That's a classic. Dr. Google doesn't know what they are on about. But I think that's the ambiguity about it and the danger of you know, we all do it, and I do exactly the right thing, Charlie.
I made the exact same Google search about 20 minutes ago.
So, you know, and if you dig into that, where does it come from? Sorry, Alex.
Wikipedia.
So just sort of concluding thoughts.
Well, I just want to add to that another paper that I know we're not talking about by Richard Bailey also explores physical literacy. And while in this paper they call it a seductive notion, he calls it a promiscuous notion. It just means anything to everyone. It'll do whatever anyone wants them to do. And I think that's potentially part of the problem with physical literacy.
I think Alex is right on, though. As soon as we start to take physical literacy and put it in a box, or you know, start to make it fit to every situation, then it loses its original intention. I think we have to be careful. I think Alex is right on.
It's like people who collect butterflies and collect birds' eggs. You know, they kind of, they when you pin them down to a board, they can't, you know, they lose their purpose. And I guess that's one of the difficulties here is that, you know, I nearly said this, but I'll be really careful. But it's like belief in a religion, a belief in a God. People, you know, the big question is, why do you believe this? And there is actually a real connection to that. So I think from a philosophical position, you know, I know, Alex, you've done a lot of work in Stoicism and those sorts of ideas, and you can't nail that down to anything. It's a way, and I think that's the important thing, is that physical literacy is a way of thinking about life, a life course devoted to movement, but I think that's probably limiting it itself as well. So it's quite difficult. I think the real problem is that you can't sell that idea to a policymaker. And that's where it becomes difficult. Well, how can we measure this? How do we know that we, as politicians, we have made a difference in the world? Well, these are the things we'll look for. And that changes the notion of what it is. And it's the reality of life is that, you know, as soon as you have to measure something, it loses some of its, I guess it loses, especially a philosophy, it loses some of its freedom.
That's a great point, Ash. And that's kind of what I was getting to with the assessment conundrum. As soon as we add assessment, not that assessment is a bad thing, but assessment, you need assessment to grow. It's a part of the learning cycle for sure. But as soon as we start to put parameters on an idea, a goal, a vision, it moves the goalposts, and that's what we have to be weary of. When we look at the plant in the backyard, and we look at it from week one to week two to week three, the plant grows. We don't have to measure the water and the sunlight and the talking to it and giving the plant a name and all that fun stuff, but we know that all of that takes place. When you start to think about these broader concepts and start to put them in circles or try to make them fit into certain areas and then add assessment to it and measurement, it loses its original purpose.
And that's where our discussions ended. I'd like to thank Cameron and Charlie for their insights as pre-service teachers, and Alex and Clancy for lending their thoughts to our discussion. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and hopefully you'll choose to catch up with us next time when we talk about trauma-aware pedagogies.